I'm Marilyn McCarney. Betsy Payette and I are interviewing personnel who were or are instrumental in developing Renfrew Museum and Park. Today is June 14th, 1993, and Patricia Shepherd, or Trish as she is called, is being interviewed. Trish is on the faculty for the Institute teaching environmental education, and particularly the wetlands. She has done an ecological assessment of the park to determine how it was doing environmentally.
Trish, how did you happen to come to Renfrew to work here in the park?
I had just finished up a job in Virginia with the Smithsonian Institution and was sort of a go-between. This project that I worked on, the ecological assessment, had been started by a friend of mine at Shippensburg University.
What was her name?
Chris Kleindienst.
Yes, I remember seeing that in the minutes.
Mm-hmm. She did not finish the project, and we wanted somebody to pick up the project. The money had been allocated by the board of directors, and so they asked me if I would step in and finish up her project, looking at what was here at Renfrew in terms of animals and plants, and what it might have looked like when the settlers came here before it was developed. I started that project, I believe it was the fall of 89, and I looked at particularly the trees in the different parts of the park. What were the dominant species? What we have here today for trees as well as saplings, what might develop in the future. I looked at wildflowers. I did some trapping for small mammals to determine what we had here. And then I tried to go back through the history and records as to what might have been here in the past. Probably the park itself would have been mostly trees when the settlers came. Some of the animals that might have been here, we no longer have, things like mountain lions, black bears, probably more beaver than we have today. A lot of them were wiped out by the mid to late 1800s. Although Pennsylvania has beaver today, they're all reintroduced beavers. The beaver was completely wiped out of Pennsylvania in the early 1900s and had to be reintroduced. The trees and the forest that was probably in this area was an oak forest, but also was probably dominated by American chestnut. The American chestnut was wiped out in the eastern half of the United States in the early to mid 1900s from the chestnut blight that was introduced. So in terms of the trees, that was probably the biggest difference from back then to today. Trees we know they had around here in the late 1700s to the early 1800s, they had walnuts, maples, locust, oaks, hickory. So they haven't changed a great deal. The size of them would have. Back then they would have been a lot larger. They would have been part of the virgin forest, never been cut. So they were probably a good 200-year-old trees that they would have had to cut down in order to develop Waynesboro and Renfrew. We believe the meadow, which is across the Antietam Creek, I call it the natural meadow, was probably a meadow back then. It has springs in it that we believe were used by the Indians. And Doris Goldman feels that, for the past 200 or so years, that was probably a meadow, either a natural meadow back then or one that was maintained by the Indians. Since they used the springs that were there, we know there are Indian sites on the adjacent farm, which is Kenny Stouffer's farm right now. And they probably would have come to the springs to get water, and they may have used the meadow for hunting.
Now, can you tell a little bit more where the meadow is? I'm not quite sure. Across from where on the creek?
Where the grist mill is?
Yes.
If you go across that footbridge, that area that's now meadow, it's being overgrown, but that is the area that I call the natural meadow. So that was probably meadow, and the rest of the area was probably forested. In the early 1800s, mid-1800s, the farms would have kept a woodlot on them, even though they would have cut down most of the trees. About 20% of the farms probably would have been in woodlot, so they would have had a wood supply for their fires and a constant wood supply. Here at Renfrew, the Royers also had property up on the mountain near Red Run Park, which they would have used to get wood for building as well as for the tannery. They needed the oak bark for the tannery, so they could. They also had a supply of wood up on the mountain. Things that are here today that wouldn't have been here when the Royers were here, some of the wildflowers, a lot were introduced. Things like dandelion, chicory, Queen Anne's lace, a lot of these that are weed species, but that we assume as wildflowers were here, they were all introduced by the Europeans. Honeysuckle, which we have, it was also introduced. 200 years ago, the most common climbing vine would have been poison ivy. So a lot of the wildflowers that we look at and we have here would have been an introduced species. Things and birds, the robin was not very common back then. Neither was the mockingbird. The starlings, the house sparrows were also introduced species, which they have done a job now on the bluebirds, purple martins, as well as some of the woodpecker species. They've outcompeted them. So our perception of Pennsylvania and the amount of woods it has today, although we consider it a lot, back then almost all of Pennsylvania was covered by woods, which is where Pennsylvania gets its name. It means Penn's Woods. There was writing by William Penn that when people were developing Pennsylvania, his suggestion was for every 5 acres that was cleared, 1 acre should be left in wooded forest. There's no way of knowing whether the people followed his advice or not, but today there's very little of the forest left when the settlers came. There's less than 1% of the virgin forest left in Pennsylvania. We know in Lancaster County, by the late 1700s, 90% of the land had already been cleared. So that was pretty common in terms of they went through and cleared most of the land as they were setting up their farms, and then would have kept small woodlots on each of the farms. We have some records of farms around here, more from the mid to late 1800s, of what percentage of their farm was in woodlot, what percentage was in natural meadow, what percentage was being farmed. And it comes out to be just about 20% of the farm area would have been in woodlot. And what they would have done with the farming is they would have grown agriculture on it for maybe 5 or so years, and then they would have left it to go back in what they call fallow, so that would rejuvenate the soil, and then they'd rotate their crops around in terms of what they would have grown.
Trish, how did you verify that there were not many robins and other birds that you mentioned present at the time of the settlers?
Because those particular birds need a lot of open space. And there would not have been a lot of open space back then. It mostly would have been forested. So as the land cleared, And we have some records going back into the 1800s of birds and sightings that they started to increase. The more land was cleared, the more open space there was, these birds started to increase in number, as well as the cardinal, again, was a bird that moved up as forest was cleared and there was a lot more open space. They started to increase in number.
Moved up from the south, or what do you mean by up?
The cardinal would have moved up more from the south and extended its range northward as the forests were cleared. There were other birds, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, that increased in that. Well, the turkey was here originally. The turkey was quite abundant and then decreased as forests were cleared, and now has been reintroduced, and its numbers are again stable. The white-tailed deer, which we associate with Pennsylvania, was another one that increased its numbers as the forests were starting to be cleared. 200, 300 years ago, the elk would have been the most abundant hoofed mammal in Pennsylvania. As the forests were cleared, then again, as the forests were cleared, then the white-tailed deer increased in number. Today we have a large abundance of white-tailed deer in Pennsylvania, but back then they would have been very few in number.
Could you give us an idea of your educational training so you were able to do this ecological assessment?
I got a bachelor's degree from New England College in Henniker, New Hampshire. The degree was in environmental science, and that was in 1986. I have a master's degree in science in biology from Shippensburg University in 1988. I've worked for the Pennsylvania Biological Survey in determining the status of all the mammals that are present in Pennsylvania. I have worked for the Smithsonian Institution in Front Royal, Virginia, at their Conservation and Research Center, looking at studying trees, studying deer, small mammals, and looking at regeneration of forests and the impact that deer and small mammals have on consuming acorns. I've worked here at Renfrew then doing the ecological assessment, and I'm currently on the faculty at Renfrew as well as the faculty of Shippensburg University teaching biology and environmental science courses.
This is the faculty of the institute?
Yes.
Rather than the museum.
Renfrew Institute.
Faculty.
Mm-hmm.
How did you actually get here to Renfrew, though? We still haven't established that, Trish.
Okay, I had finished up working for the Smithsonian Institution in Virginia and was recovering from reconstructive knee surgery. I was in this area because I was engaged to Will Shepherd. Renfrew was looking for someone to complete this project, and I had been a Shippensburg University graduate in ecology or biology, and so James approached me to see if I would be interested in finishing Chris's project and to sort of smooth things over between Renfrew and Shippensburg, since the project had been started through them but was not completed.
Have you used data from your assessment with your teaching at the institute?
I use some in the wetlands. When we go out to the wet meadow, I talk about the springs, how the Indians used them, how that was probably a natural meadow for the past couple of hundred years, and how the Indians would have gotten water from the springs and maybe hunted in the meadow. I also use some of this when I teach the dairy class. I started teaching the dairy culture this past spring. So I've relied on some of the history that I found out about the environment and try and bring it into the dairy class to sort of connect the two, that the environment as well as history go hand in hand, and to sort of make the connection between environmental education as well as the history.
Can you tell us anything about the Antietam? Has anything changed about that in the last hundreds of years?
I didn't really look at too much the course or the size of it in particular. I did relate it to what was going on here at Renfrew. When the grist mill was operating, they would have diverted water from the Antietam to the grist mill. So the flow of water in the Antietam would have been decreased at that time. I also looked at some of the impact the tannery would have had, in that the Antietam today is probably a lot cleaner than it was back then. They would have had a lot of the tannic acids and the chemicals they were using in the tannery would have gotten flushed down the Antietam, as well as their cows would have used it and other animals as a drinking water supply, so that the natural manure and fertilizer would have gone right into the Antietam. So today it probably is a lot cleaner than it was back then, and it's maybe flowing faster with more water in it today because of them using the water to power mills, not just the one here at Renfrew, but they would have been using it in other areas along the creek.
Where are the springs located?
Okay, in the natural meadow, they're located, if you go all the way to the end of Renfrew's property, follow the power line down, there is a gully that always has water in it. Some of the springs are located right at the end of the power line. There are a number of them out there, at probably at least five or six off the top of my head, that you can actually see them bubbling up to the top where the springs come up. Even when we had the drought a couple of years ago, the springs were always flowing. Not quite as much, but they were always flowing, and there was always water in that part of the wet meadow. We do know that the property has quite a number of springs on it that they would have used for the water supply. There's one in the back part at the Fahnestock house. There was a couple of them that are coming out right where they would have had a spring house, and right going down into the tail race of the mill. So the property has a number of springs on it, and they always seem to be flowing. They don't stop even in the drought weather.